Welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, after the murder of Mahsa Amini, Iran has seen mass protests and demonstrations and an ongoing resistance movement against its regime. What best explains the origins and persistence of this movement? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. In September 2022, Mahsa Amini and her family, who had traveled from Iran's Kurdistan region and were visiting relatives in the capital of Tehran, were stopped by a patrol of morality police, a dedicated unit that enforces strict dress codes for women, such as wearing the compulsory headscarf and to wear it properly. She was arrested and was killed under police custody. Iranians throughout the country have risen up in protest with a series of demonstrations and protests which continue today. On today's show, we will explore the status of women in Iran, the potential for political change in the Islamic nation. We'll examine broadly the role of gender within the nation, within Islam, and ways in which human rights issues have been framed, particularly under the history of Western intervention in the nation. Our guests today are Persis Karim, the Neda Nobari Chair of the Center for Iranian Diaspora Studies and a professor in the Comparative and World Literature Department at San Francisco State University. She's the author of Let Me Tell You Where I've Been, New Writing by Women of the Iranian Diaspora, and Nayare Tohidi, Professor Emerita in the Department of Gender and Women's Studies and Middle East and Islamic Studies at California State University, Northridge. She's the author of Women's Rights and Feminist Movements in Iran. Thank you both very much for joining us. Professor Tohidi, first, the protests will begin in the fall of last year. And one of the things that's been rather striking for those of us who have been observing from outside is just how sustained the protests have been. There's been kind of this constant presence of protests. What exactly is the state of the protests in Iran? And what are some of the causes of the fact that this has been such a apparently sustained movement?
Yes, thank you for inviting me. I want to go over a few aspects of this movement, which I call revolutionary movement, but it doesn't mean that a revolution is happening right now or we are at a state of revolutionary situation. I want to emphasize that this has not been an overnight incident or a singular protest movement. Iran has been experiencing several nationwide protests and uprisings. Actually, the first massive protest was in 1979, right after the inception of the Islamic regime, which was by women. Women took on the streets on March 8th of 1979. They had prepared to have a first-time nationwide celebration of the International Women's Day, but that turned into a protest movement because Ayatollah Khomeini, just a few days before that, announced that the veil hijab should be compulsory, should be mandatory in the offices for women outside home. And also, he nullified the family protection law and he removed women judges from their posts, saying that women are not made or are not capable of being judges or making reasonable judgment and decisions. So women then were very angry and they poured at least 50,000 people in Tehran per se. And they were shouting slogans such as, "We didn't make a revolution to go backward. Freedom is or equality is neither Western nor Eastern. It is global. It is international." And they were the first one who called for not only freedom and independence that people were chanting and Islamic Republic. They said, "Azadi, istiqlal, jumhuriye vaqei," freedom, independence, and real republic. This was very important. I myself discovered this just recently by listening carefully to the video that was made by some women coming from Europe to show their solidarity with women in Iran, that they were chanting also this slogan that people usually haven't noticed much, that they were asking for a real republic. So starting with that, then we had several demonstrations and protest movements, especially in provinces with ethnic minorities, like in Turkmenistan with Turkmens, and then in Kurdistan, protesting against centralized and very, you know, discriminatory policies against religious differences, religious minorities and ethnic minorities. So women's movement, of course, has been starting not only right after that March 8 demonstration, which was they lost the momentum because after 5 days of demonstration, the regime made some concession, some retreat, but it was tactical. Then they used very cleverly the start of the war to silence everybody, and the women's movement went kind of underground. But this Mahsa or Jina movement, that some also call it women life freedom movement, is an outcome of or influenced and informed by at least four generations of feminist movement in Iran that started during the Constitutional Revolution. Notwithstanding the sporadic individual protests, like there was a very short-lived protest of women taking off their veil in front of the first majlis during the revolution, the Constitutional Revolution. But it was such a no-no that even pro-constitution women denied that they had anything to do with that. So it's very important for people to know that there has been a history of women's movement, very indigenous, very homegrown movement, with different stages, different ups and downs. And so this particular movement especially is also connected to the Green Movement for Democracy that took place in 2009 and 2010. And it lasted almost a year and was brutally suppressed, of course. But that movement, even though it was nationwide and very important movement, was still within the system movement, meaning it was a reform-oriented movement. It was part of this continuous struggle within this so-called Islamic Republic, which is such a contradictory entity anyway. Always we had this struggle between the Republican elements of this government and the totalitarian theocratic elements of it. And as we have come close to the current days, the theocratic elements and the totalitarian aspects of it have become stronger and stronger and have the upper hand. And especially one turning point was during the 2021 presidential election. It is important to understand that because that itself paved the way to the current movement. Why? Because it was a turning point showing that there is no hope for reform within the system. And they tried to unify this political power by the principalists, as they call it, usulgarayan, meaning those who believe in fundamentalism and fundamentals of Islamism and theocracy and the vilayat-e-faqih supreme, you know, the absolute power of the supreme jurist, Ayatollah Khamenei. So Raisi not only tried to unify and homogenize the political, you know, ideological orientation of the government, but also he was a very hated and unbelievable candidate because his hands were bloody. He was part of the secret death squad that was responsible for killing of many political prisoners. Prisoners who many of them were about to be released. They had almost completed their terms of imprisonment, but they killed many of them, thousands of them. And thanks to Ayatollah Muntazeri, not the opposition, that we learned about this killing and atrocity. So that created a lot of complete erosion of the legitimacy of the Islamic Republic and legitimacy of the election system. And there was a very strong boycott of the elections, and the turnout was the lowest ever in the history of the Islamic Republic. So that was a turning point that created the way for call for the downfall of the regime. And the entire regime was rejected. And the manifestation of it, you see during the 2019 demonstrations, Aban, and 2020 demonstrations, that were mostly for economic reasons, for rising prices, for delayed payment of workers' salaries, and mostly economic causes, but turned political pretty soon. But this movement is very all-encompassing. It is, for the first time, liberty itself and persuasion of happiness. And the downfall of the regime as the primary demand of the protesters. And for the first time, the women's issues and the women's bodily autonomy and the mandatory hijab became a prominent factor in uprising.
And Persis Karim, I want to bring you into the conversation. There's a lot there that Professor Tahidi raised. One of the first that comes to mind is that the idea of political protest and resistance in this form is kind of baked into Iranian history, isn't it? There's been long stretches of this, that the fact that there's been this peaceful protest and the rising, the size and the intensity of those protests are quite consistent with Iranian history, correct?
I think Professor Tahidi laid out very effectively and smartly the idea that this didn't begin, you know, in fall 2022, but is part of a long series of convulsions in the history of Iran, where at different points, people were asking for some of the basic principles of democratic participation and political liberty and personal liberty. But I think it's a culmination of probably most directly the last 44 years in which the Islamic Republic has cemented its power largely by funding the mechanisms for policing both domestically and regionally. And as a result, there's a lot of corruption, political corruption, economic corruption. You have add in that the sanctions. And what I see that's different about this moment is that not only is it woman-led, it's also youth-led in a way that we've never seen before. And part of it is, I think we have to really understand the internal dynamics of Iran. Is the leadership of Iran is the average age is 70, and more than 65% of the population in Iran is under 35. So you have this demographic contrast between who's in leadership and their ideas and who the majority of the population is. This is largely a Gen Z moment where you have young people who are widely connected to the rest of the world. They're not aspiring to something just in terms of what's local. They're aspiring to be connected to the rest of the world. And this is a regime that has caused Iran's profound isolation from not just the West, but from the rest of the world through many of its policies. And I would say the other thing is that Iranian youth are a reflection of some dynamics of change over the last 40 years. If you think about it, one of the best things about the revolution was that it allowed women and girls to attend schools and universities at an unprecedented level. The literacy among women is greater than it's ever been. Women are the backbone of university programs now in a way that has never been before. So you have the rising expectations of women and girls because they have more education, they have more access to the rest of the world through their little cell phone device, and they're expecting something different, that population. And they're also, like the rest of the world, acutely aware of rising unemployment, economic disparities, corruption of their government, and the environmental crisis, which is particularly important to Iran's future, that is water. So whether it's one, I don't think it's one thing, as I think Professor Tohidi is suggesting, it's a culmination of many earlier moments in history, but the now of it is also some of the dynamics of young people and also young women who are dealing with second-class citizenship in Iran, where they're expected, for example, if they get a university education, they're limited by what kinds of career choices they can make. They're policed more harshly than men. The morality police, engage in all sorts of shaming, humiliation, and bodily policing on a regular basis. And the other, I think, earlier moment that Professor Tohidi references is that women have been at the forefront of earlier movements to try and reform the Islamic Republic. So you had the 1 million signatures campaign in the early 2000s. Shirin Ebadi, who's the 2003 Nobel Peace Prize winner, was engaged with that. Nasrin Sotoudeh, who's a political prisoner now, she was an attorney representing some of the interests of that campaign. Many of the people who were involved in the 1 million signatures campaign were arrested and have served or continue to be serving long sentences. So the response of efforts to reform has been met with equally harsh punishments of those, and it's perceived as a kind of traitorous act, right? They've been accused of being spies. They've been accused of being pro-Western, anti-Islamic. So I do think that's, women have been at the forefront, but this is a unique moment in the idea of youth-led and women-led for Iran. And also, I think it's non-ideological, right? They're not seeking an ideology to replace the one. They're seeking an end to this regime's severe control and policing of its own population.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. Today, we're discussing the protest movements, the status of women, gender in Iran, with Persis Karim of San Francisco State University and Nayari Tohidi of California State University, Northridge. Professor Karim, I want to follow up because I have to admit, I'm a bit surprised at your observation about the role that women have been playing in education, because, of course, the images we get in the West is that this really is, as an Islamic regime, it's a regime that's targeted against women's rights, at least at some point. And you highlighted some of those issues like the morality police and the way women get policed. But then women have been thriving at the universities. Are they thriving despite government policy? What's behind the advancement of women in university positions within Iran? Is it more social? Is it more political? Is it directed? I'm really kind of curious.
One of the effects of the 1979 revolution was to both restrict women and also give them access to something like education, because many Iranian families were concerned about sending their daughters to schools. So the gender segregation is really an ability to allow women to go to girls' schools. So you see some of the protests that are happening in some of the schools right now in Iran, the high schools, some of them are exclusively girls' schools or universities where women and men are segregated. You know, they can't eat lunch together. So they have this kind of paradox of both being allowed to do some of the things men can do and boys, and yet there are also these very clear limitations being set. So I think education has been a tool of raising expectations for young women and the idea that they should be allowed the same rights as men because they're actually moving in some of the same social and political spheres as men are. And I want to hand it over to Dr. Tohidi to see if she wants to add something, because I think she knows even more than I do.
Absolutely. Yeah. Same question. And what has that meant for women's leadership in this movement and generally in society?
It's a very good question. And Professor Karim gave a part of the answer that I think was quite right. And I want to add a few more things. It actually helps us to understand again the complexity and paradoxes and contradictory nature of the whole dynamics within the political structure of this regime, which was a product of a revolution. Remember that. The dynamism of revolution went on for many years. People who had experienced their power by going to the street and bringing down a very powerful dictatorship, you can't now tell them, millions of women who took to the streets demanding freedom. They had made some achievements during the previous regime, under the Shah's regime. The process of education and modernization had started since even the Qajar dynasty. After the constitutional revolution, women had gained the right to education. Schooling had become very important. So we had already a very strong and visible middle-class women who were highly educated and professional. Many of them had jobs. And it was those women who made the first protests against the Khomeini's retrogressive measures against women. Women were first target of regression under his government. So remember, Khomeini also had opposed the right to vote for women. One of the reasons why he made his first protest movement against the Shah, Khomeini, was the right to vote for women. He opposed that. They opposed the whole measures of the so-called white revolution that Mohammad Reza Shah, you know, waged as a reform. And there were some positive aspects to that reform. The problem was that it was done all by the Shah. It was very authoritarian, top-down process, right? And it alienated many people because the middle class didn't ever get the chance to participate in decision-making and to own that process of modernization. So it was very dual society, very authoritarian process of modernization. Nevertheless, these women, these mothers were not going to let their daughters to stay home and not to have the same education they had. Khomeini was smart enough to understand that. First of all, he could not take back the right to vote from women. Instead, he said, actually, women should be present in the public and protect the Islamic government. Right. So he encouraged the traditional women to actually gain education, to become more educated and powerful so that they can compete with this modern, secular, middle class women as a constituency of the government. In other words, Khomeini needed these women. That's why he said, "Dar sahne hazir bashid," be in present in the scene, the political scene. That was the ironic, process that Khomeini himself never predicted, that this many of these women, Islamist women even, are going to become disillusioned with its government. And they did. They also joined the feminist movement. Some of them from Islamic framework tried to reinterpret Islam in a different way, tried to argue for the Republican elements of the government to be allowed to have their own organizations and reform the Sharia law, the family law, which was very and has been and still is very patriarchal and discriminatory against women. So people should understand this diversity within the system and this contradictions. So in other words, the universities, the free university that Rafsanjani himself benefited economically, of course, from it, but these universities offered affordable education to many women and men. So we have, like, as Professor Karim said, 55% of university students, at least, even more, are women. And that, so that is one reason why this happened, despite the ideology of the more extreme Islamists. But political necessity made it necessary for Khomeini to allow this and to even encourage women's political activism. But the other reality is that this is a global pattern. Don't forget that everywhere in the world, including in the MENA region, Middle East and North Africa, women have been dramatically becoming socialized and educated. Women in many places, women outperforming men in higher education and becoming better educated, because education is like universities are losing their economic, many men are losing their economic incentive to continue higher education because they are entering more easily into the market economy that women cannot. And many of these highly educated women in Iran and other countries, like in Saudi Arabia even, do not have access to employment. The rates of unemployment among highly educated women in Iran are twice as much as men's unemployment. So we have to see all aspects of this contradictory situation. Another contradictory situation is that while women are highly educated, in Iran, there is only 6% of political representation of women in the parliament, in the government. Only 5% of women educated and even working women have administrative positions, leading positions. And of course, women cannot even run for public offices other than just, being a deputy in the parliament. Many of the highly important, powerful political positions are banned for women, especially they cannot become member of the constituency or the Shura-i Negahban, the Guardian Council, or they cannot become president. So there are many contradictions in Iran's legal system and practical policies that we need to understand. Otherwise, as Professor Karim said, that's why many women have their expectations have been frustrated, because they know they have the power, they know they can, they know about the world. And that's why I always call, especially even this generational factor, which is very important and Professor Karim mentioned, is a global process. Globalization is a process that the regime couldn't do much about it. Mm-hmm. People have access to the internet. They know that other women, how they are empowered now, they are participating in many fields of, different realms of society. But in Iran, they are very limited. And that's why you have this movement led by women, because first of all, there has been a strong feminist movement that has increased awareness and feminist consciousness among women, but also these women and the youth that have been main target of oppression and humiliation. So this movement is to take back their dignity, to take back people's lives. They keep talking about normal life. If you want to understand this movement, just try to translate the song Baraye Four by Shervin Hajipur. That song is the manifesto, at least the early manifesto of this movement. It shows all the issues this movement is concerned about. It's not only the veil. It's, of course, women's bodily autonomy and freedom of choice is a primary concern, but everything from the environmental destruction that has been in process, the water shortage, the animal abuses in this system, and the economic issues, they don't see any viable future for them this year in this. So there are many issues that have been intersected, the ethnic, discrimination. So there are layers of oppression that can be, even seen in the identity of Mahsa Amini herself, her identity being a woman, young woman, the gender issue, sexuality issue, being a Kurd, the Kurdishness of her is an important factor that mobilized Kurdish population and ethnic minorities. Look, for the first time, there is a very strong sense of solidarity across ethnic groups and across different provinces in Iran. Baluchistan and Kurdistan are the most active, Azerbaijan the same, and Lors are active. So that is another layer that Mahsa symbolizes. And Sunni, Mahsa was also Sunni religion. This Shia, sectarian hegemony that has been enforced and imposed on people itself is a cause for, dissatisfaction and disillusion among many people.
When we come back, what has influenced Iran's resistance movement? How much has been influenced by women's rights activists and protesters throughout the world and the region? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Iran has a substantial number of diaspora around the world. They help frame the issues that are occurring inside its borders. What is the interaction between Iranians abroad and Iranians in Iran and the resistance movement going on right now in the nation? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Our guests today are Persis Karim, the Neda Nobari Chair of the Center for Iranian Diaspora Studies and Professor in the Comparative and World Literature Department at San Francisco State University, and Naira Tohidi, Professor Emerita in the Department of Gender and Women's Studies and Middle East and Islamic Studies at California State University, Northridge. And so, Persis Karim, I want to turn to you. I know you've done quite a bit of work on diaspora movements, the role of Iranians, outside of Iran. My own knowledge of what's been going on in Iran is largely framed by the large Iranian diaspora community here in Los Angeles. And I think certainly the diaspora community has had a pretty profound impact on the way in which Americans have viewed this. What exactly is the relationship between Iranians abroad, Iranians at home, and the nature of this movement?
I think one of the most important things is that the largest number of Iranians arrived in the United States as a result of 1979, the revolution, the establishment of the Islamic Republic, and then the 8-year-long war between Iran and Iraq. So it's impossible to look at diaspora in an abstract way. Many of the people who are now actively engaged in these protests within the diaspora are either the product of that migration from Iran or the children of that the many millions who left Iran and scattered around the world, the largest of which is in Los Angeles and the largest population in California, combining Northern and Southern California. So I think it's kind of impossible to separate that history of 44 years ago from how people are engaged with the history that's being made now. Many of those who left under duress, left maybe perhaps temporarily, imagining that this regime change would result in something else, and came here thinking it was temporary, but eventually realized they were going to have to stay here or go back. So I think one of the really key pieces of that is that we've had a continuous history of connection to Iran because of the generations that have migrated here. And not everybody who's here came right at 1979 or 1980. There were subsequent migrations out of Iran as a result of, say, the 2009 protests. So there's a long history of people who have living memory of the oppression of this regime, and therefore feel some stake in what happens in Iran. And they also have traumas of having either been forced to leave or choosing to leave, but not really wanting to. The connections between people in the diaspora in Iran have also been somewhat mitigated by this very long and tense relationship between the government of Iran and the government of the United States. And then you have a media, and I have to say this, the US media has been, parroting kind of policy wonk talk about Iran so that you don't ever see anything about Iranians in everyday context, either in Iran or here. They're always conflated with the Islamic Republic and its behavior. And so this moment, I think, is one where people are suddenly seeing Iran represented in the eyes of the world in a much more positive, freedom-loving, independent, youthful way. And so there's a level of both excitement, inspiration, pride, awe at the kind of courage of young people in Iran to stand up to this very brutal response from the regime. The media, unfortunately, coverage of it has waned somewhat, I think, since October. Of course, censorship inside of Iran, the shutting down of the internet, the arrest of journalists, is one factor. But I think we also have a media that has pretty much had no other sophisticated understanding of Iran other than what the policymakers have been parroting to them, which is, Iran is our boogeyman. We're at this, I think, really important moment where people are looking at young people and recognizing the absolute bravery, particularly of women, to confront that regime. And I think the other way it resonates, at least for me, is this is a moment where women's rights are being attacked everywhere. Afghanistan, United States of America. We just lost the most important right for women in the last year was the right to bodily autonomy and the expression of reproductive rights. And it's continuing unabated with the passage of additional laws state by state about restricting, medications for abortion. So I don't think it's lost on people that this is a moment where there's an attack on individual rights of women, but also of ethnic minorities or trans and gay people in this country. So the optics of what's happening in Iran are kind of easy to identify with, I would say. And I think for young Iranian Americans, for example, it's a moment where they see some connection to themselves. Just as young people in Iran want to be connected to the rest of the world, young Iranian Americans want to be connected to an Iran that they have been hungering to know and has been off limits to them. And the media has also kind of controlled the narrative, if you will, for a very long time. And so I think that the role of social media cannot be understated in making a visibility for Iran that has never been there before. There was a little bit of it in the Green Movement. But this is, you know, kind of unprecedented. And I think one of the things about the diaspora that's really important is they are using social media to help craft a narrative about the events taking place in Iran. And that's, of course, you know, visible in social media like Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. And that it's kind of a form of civilian journalism, which is absolutely necessary because there's no journalistic coverage or very little happening inside of Iran. And I would even argue, like, I'm a little bit perplexed at how little the US media understands the importance of continuing to find angles. And there are lots of experts in this country that they could be talking to.
Professor Tahini, one of the things I was thinking about with this was this observation that you find wherever you have news sources. And one of the reasons we wanted to cover this now is because this is a narrative that's been lost a bit, you know, to the news, and we need to return back to it. But this stressing the youth movement and the point that majority of Iranians, you know, today in Iran were not alive during the revolution. And so therefore, how much of this is just kind of a natural tendency to say that the further you get away from the revolution, the easier it is to lose the principles of the revolution, or lose the passion for the revolution, or possibly at times go back to a pre-revolutionary Iran. And then how much of this is really much more so, and I think you both have been highlighting this, that the best way to view this movement is about women's movements, you know, from the region and throughout the world. That's one of the reasons why Iranian women are protesting is because women all over the world are protesting because they're seeing their rights eroding.
Yeah, both of you said that this is a global movement. It has a transnational message, what's happening in Iran now. The Jina movement, women, life, freedom, the various slogan can resonate with everybody in the world who's yearning for freedom, for equality, for women's rights. And those who understand the intimate connection between women's dignity and freedom of choice to the dignity of the whole nation. You know, in Iran, this the tragic killing of Mahsa Amini in custody of the morality police was like George Floyd moment for Iran. It kind of revealed the blatant sexism in Iran. If George Floyd's moment revealed the blatant racism, systemic racism within the police structure here in this country, and resulted in a national and even international outrage against racism, the killing of Mahsa was the moment, because it wasn't a singular thing. Women were being killed several times, and men too, in prison, under custody of the regime, and in the hands of the morality police. So, but this was covered. It was very hard for them to hide it and to fabricate the cause. And they tried to say, well, she had in her medical record some problem. She died of, it wasn't related to the beating and the brutal attacks on her body by the police. So that's why the journalists, I want to, before I forget, to name these two women. If in the US it was a woman, young woman who filmed the incident of George Floyd, in Iran, two young women journalists were played key role in publicizing this story. And they were Niloufar Hamedi and Elahe Mohammadi, both of them seasoned journalists who went to the hospital, took pictures of Mahsa while in a coma, and interviewed her parents. And they are in prison. Instead of persecuting the murderers, the regime just arrested those two women, and they are sentenced to 5 years of imprisonment, and they are still in prison. By the way, just a couple of days ago, they received another prize from Harvard University for their courage and honesty in journalism. So, yes, the journalists, as Professor Karim mentioned, unfortunately in Iran are so controlled and repressed that they cannot report what's going on exactly these days, especially now that the streets are taken back under the control of the repressive police or the security organs of the regime. So you don't see that many people on the streets. So the movement is kind of doesn't have the same, you know, daily demonstrations that we used to see and report by the civil journalism, mostly right. By social.
Although to follow that up, there still are individual acts of protest, right?
Oh, yes, of course. You know,
individuals on hunger strikes and specific.
Even within the prisons, there are actions and there are resistance. Even they have turned the Nowruz, the New Year festivity, into political activism. Many women are still daring not to cover their hair. You can see many of them on the streets without any cover of hair. And you can see women and men are dancing on the street. Any performance that relate to music, to beauty, to dance, to happiness, are political statements. That is how this regime, that's why they are saying that we want our normal life back. Because this regime has been against laughter, against beauty, against music. Still in Iran's TV, you cannot show musical instruments. So if the media here have not been doing as much and as well as we expect, I want to be fair and not just blame the media, because it has been hard. There has been a lot of censorship, but also it has been hard to find issues that many people in different parts of the world can relate to it. So fortunately, this movement, the youth and women have succeeded not to make internationally, not only nationally, themselves visible. It says, here, look, Iran is not just the government of Iran. We are here. Many people in Iran, majority of people, at least 85% of Iranians now are fed up with this regime. And this movement is post-Islamism. As Dr. Parsis Karim said, it is non-ideological, but it is asserting a worldview contrary, opposite to the worldview and ideology of the regime. It is totally against Islamism, against imposition of any ideology. It is for pluralism. It is for democracy. It is for equal rights. It is for intersectionality. Its feminism has an intersectional approach. And it is for ethnic diversity. It is for sexual orientation diversity. So these are all, that's why I'm saying this is for the most part a cultural revolutionary movement, a cultural movement for the most part, even though it has political elements, of course, as well. But it is because it's creating, it is asserting a different culture. And that's why internationally, many countries, state people and ordinary people and celebrities and artists and scientists and social scientists all are supporting. And that is very heartening for people in Iran that they have got this support, international support. As you mentioned, Professor Becker, because majority of the younger people are born after the revolution, they have not experienced the problems that we experienced under the previous regime. That is, despite a lot of positive things and the freedom, the civil freedom that we had under the Pahlavi dynasty, but we didn't have political rights. It was very suppressive regime with respect to, we didn't have, you know, free elections. We didn't have different parties. It ended having one party and the Shah declared that you either join this party or just leave the country. So there were problems, but unfortunately the young people have become, and understandably, very nostalgic about the past and part of the media run by the diaspora has been glorifying this nostalgia and want us to take back to the past rather than moving forward. Even the prince himself, Reza Pahlavi, Mr. Pahlavi, is more democratic and more future oriented than some of his, you know, followers, unfortunately. Although fortunately there is a better unity now, even among the diaspora people, there are different charters now being formulated by the diaspora communities that are trying to envision the future. And that is good process. That's why I mentioned the conference before this discussion. We talked about the Stanford conference, and there are many conferences that people are trying to, in a safe place, you know, free from accusations and at physical or verbal attacks, to come with a united leadership that is grounded, well-grounded inside Iran, but also supported by the diaspora community outside. So that is now a very sensitive mission that now the diaspora community is trying to pursue, and but it's not going to be easy.
And Persis Karim, we have about 3 minutes left. I want to make sure, though, to give you an opportunity to respond. And I mean, ultimately, what's the best way to view what's been going on in Iran with the protest movements, and what should we be looking for as we examine this going into the future?
Well, I want to thank Professor Tohidi for mentioning that aspect of the Iranian diaspora, because not everybody has been united. And I do think one of the things that's really important about the future of this movement is to recognize there are some dark actors afoot. And some of the division that has been sowed within the Iranian diaspora has been at the hands of states like Saudi Arabia and Israel. Because remember, a revolution in Iran for us personally looks like a good idea, but for other actors in the region, it might not bode so well. And Saudi Arabia, you know, they have policies that are even more restrictive against women. So I think whether or not, I think this movement is succeeding in ways that we can't measure it today, but it's succeeding in part because it's building on previous moments. And then finally, I think it's really important to recognize that the geopolitics of Iran cannot be separated from other things that are happening right now, including Ukraine, including Afghanistan, including the fact that there have been these major conflicts in the region over the last 25 years that have made the Iranian regime so paranoid, you know, ISIS and what's taking place in Syria. So the part for me that's really optimistic and important to emphasize is what's happening inside of Iran. And this is where, like, I probably would say I'm all about building solidarity so that the people of Iran can determine for themselves. And that is one of the limitations, I think, of the diaspora. We don't live there. We don't breathe the oxygen of what's taking place. So the best thing that I think we can do is to continue to amplify what's taking place in Iran, building conversations about how to support what's taking place in Iran, but not necessarily believing that we have the answer, because to a great extent, it's for the people of Iran to determine their future. And I feel really strongly that that has been one of the things that you can see among people in the diaspora, is this wish to have it look a certain way, including a kind of nostalgia that Professor Tohidi mentioned about the past, which doesn't seem realistic. And I don't think most of those young people, they're not interested in the replacement of one for the other, the past for the present. They're interested in something else. And that's why I think this is a really powerful movement globally. And then the other one thing that I think is really important is that it doesn't represent the kinds of ideological leadership-led movements that we've seen before. So there's lots of unknowns before us. And that's both what makes it exciting and inspiring, and also cause for trepidation, because this regime will stop at nothing to hold on to power, including killing many of its young people who are the future of that country.
I think this is a fitting place to end at least, you know, today's conversation, in the spirit of what Professor Karim just said about the importance of amplifying what's going on and giving us a chance to at least witness and try to understand what's been going on in Iran. Maybe the most important thing that I take from today is this is a story that has lost the headlines, and we need to keep paying attention to the story, keep these conversations, and view the relationship between those of us outside of Iran and those in Iran as a conversation that ultimately, certainly from my perspective, I should be doing a lot more listening and a lot less talking and trying to learn from that. And so in that spirit, I want to thank our guests today. Our guests today have been Persis Karim, the Neda Nobari Chair of the Center of Iranian Diaspora Studies and a professor in the Comparative and World Literature Department at San Francisco State University. She's the author of Let Me Tell You Where I've Been, New Writing by Women of the Iranian Diaspora. And Nayara Tohidi, Professor Emerita in the Department of Gender and Women's Studies and Middle East and Islamic Studies at California State University, Northridge. She's the author of Women's Rights and Feminist Movements in Iran. Thank you both very much for joining us.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankina Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Seb Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.